Welcome, everyone. It's Andrew Thompson here, General Manager of CFMG Capital, and I'd like to welcome you to the latest episode of Smart Capital. As I say, we're always looking for new ways to communicate with our growing community of investors to keep them up to date with the latest happenings at CFMG Capital, but also the world of wealth generation. We started this podcast as a forum for all sorts of discussions and to provide some insight into how we approach investment management and the opportunities we see, and also just give a bit of brief commentary on areas we operate, areas such as the state of the property market, challenges in development, and private credit. Each month, we'll be inviting a different guest to have a chat about their area of expertise to help you on your journey to financial freedom. Our guest this week is Ross Elliott. Ross is an experienced executive and advisor with over 35 years in urban development, infrastructure, and public policy, currently chairing the Brisbane Lord Mayor's Better Suburbs Initiative, and is director of a not-for-profit urban research and policy organisation, Suburban Futures. Ross has held senior executive roles at the Property Council of Australia, was inaugural CEO of Brisbane Marketing, and has also led construction businesses in Queensland, such as Copran Construction and APP. Welcome, Ross.
Thanks, Andrew.
The theme for this week's podcast is all about challenges and opportunities in the Southeast Queensland land market. There is a bit to unpack here, so let's start with how would you characterise the current conditions in Southeast Queensland, particularly in the greenfield market?
That's a big question. Look, basically, I'd say it's broken. And it's been broken for a very long time. I think all that's happening now is that we're starting to realise that it's broken because the evidence is hard to walk away from. How did it start off being broken? Well, the business as usual model, led by the usual suspects, has told us for 30 years that we can't sprawl, pejorative term, can't go out. We've got to go up, and we've got to pursue density at all costs. So we built a we designated a growth boundary around the city in which all growth was to take place, outside of which you're allowed to graze cattle. And you know, that was it on that line. One side urban, the other side definitely not. So that basically set up a supply constraint, and then we've had population growth driving demand. And I think what's happened more recently too is that the population growth has gone from a reasonable level, a level that we could cope with, to now hyper growth, mostly because the federal government is responsible for population policy via immigration. So they've upped the immigration rate to nearly 500,000 people a year, and it used to be around 150,000. So at the same time that we've accelerated demand, we've constrained our supply physically through the growth boundary, and then we've suffered through a planning and regulatory system an increasingly clunky, slow, inflexible, unresponsive, inappropriate bunch of red tape. So to do something now takes a lot longer and it costs a lot more. And hello, we've not only got a housing shortage, we've got prices going through the roof. So yeah, it's a long way of saying it. I think it's absolutely broken, and you can't fix it by going back to the business as usual approach, and you can't fix it with listening to the usual suspects. We need to get some new people in the room.
Yeah, look, it certainly matches our experience as a what we've called a greenfield land developer. The only way to, I guess, currently at the moment to slow that growth in price is to put more supply into the market, but that's becoming more and more difficult for those of us that are trying to be part of that supply solution. I guess a little bit off that topic, but you know, we'll try and stay around it. Based on the information you've just sort of given us, would it be fair to say, you know, is it first home buyers, upgraders currently the strongest source of demand, or do you think it's investors, and how do you think it's shifting?
I think that's probably pretty cyclical. I was talking to someone recently about the wave of townhouse development that we had in Brisbane that preceded the so-called townhouse ban. And if you look back at what was being done then, a lot of it was just investor-grade stock. It was pretty average town housing. It wasn't great quality. You can understand why residents were saying, you know, this isn't what you promised. But that was a period in the market where the investors were very dominant, you know, whether it was apartment off-plan sales or whether it was any form of product, investors were going nuts. So, yeah, I think that comes and goes.
Yeah, I mean, look, my experience, well, I've never really been... Certainly in this organisation, we're not townhouse developers. We focus on greenfield land. But in my experience, there were a lot of operators in that townhouse space at the time that even if they had first home buyer or residential or owner-occupied demand. They preferred to sell to investors both for the ease of the transaction, but also they were selling management rights in most of these developments, and the management rights value went up the more investors and tenants there were. So that was a little bit of a, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm very on board with, you know, playing the blame game, so to speak, but sometimes when you let people loose unregulated, they do the wrong thing, and that's why they get regulated.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think the other thing too about the supply is it's wrong to just talk about dwellings as if they're all the same, because going back to the business as usual philosophy is that up is better than out. But as everyone in the industry will knows and will tell you, up is now supremely expensive, $15,000 a square meter, maybe more. So the only people who can buy the high density product are now the wealthiest. You can't actually deliver it for
risky for those delivering it.
Very risky. The cheapest form of building is still a brick and stick on a slab on a suburban greenfield site. So if you want quick, and it's the quickest to deliver too. So if you want to bring supply onto the market quickly at an affordable price, that's the built form model you've got to pursue, but the planning scheme discourages it. So there's the irony. At the moment, the planning scheme is supporting the most costly and the slowest and most difficult product, which is a medium to high density housing solution. So it's no wonder we've got the problems we have.
Yeah, and look, you know, even the servicing challenges of some of these greenfield markets. But I mean, I guess, you know, back to the topic at hand, the interest rates, cost of living pressures, do you think they're having a huge influence on demand profile, particularly for new land lots?
Yeah, I think, well, that new land, it's typically young families. If they're not first-time buyers, they might be second. And they're looking to get into those markets and establish themselves for the future, you know, so they're family-orientated. The drop in the interest rates, certainly, look, it's psychological. Personally, I don't think it makes a lot of difference in terms of affordability, because you're stuck with this fundamental problem that we've now made the price of a house nearly 10 times someone's income. And it doesn't really matter what happens with the interest rates. I remember back in 2007, was the last time we had a housing crisis. Interest rates were up, but retail rates might have been 8% or more, mortgage rates.
They were above 8%, yeah.
Above 8. And then we had the GFC, and we started printing money, and of course interest rates came down until it was almost free money. What happened in that intervening period, though, was that the actual cost of delivering a house didn't change. In fact, it went up because we just added more regulation, more paperwork, more compliance problems, and more scarcity of land. So the cost to deliver the product went up at the same time as the cost of servicing the debt went down. So all you had to do at the end of that period, which is what we saw a few years ago, was tweak the interest rates up a little bit, and all of a sudden we're calling 3.5%, 4% official cash rate the end of the world, because people had mortgaged themselves into an overcostly product. What's it going to do this time around? Well, interest rates aren't going to get down to official cash rate of 2% or anything like that. I can't see that happening. So it'll provide minor relief, and it'll keep the media people happy, and it'll be a boost to confidence, but I don't think it's materially going to make a lot of change to the issue of affordability.
Yeah, look, we don't see, you know, in our space, interest rates necessarily having a big impact on price, but does have an impact on demand. And I think it's, yeah, largely driven psychologically. And look, you know, to your point, you know, the median multiple, I remember like that being now 10 now. I remember first sort of looking at that number in and around about 2007-08, and I think it was around 6.6 or something like that. And even then I thought, geez, that's pretty high. And I, you know, you talk to, you know, the baby boomers, and they're all talking about, oh yeah, but my interest rate was 18%, and you can't compare. But probably the most important measure was, even back then, you know, their wages were lower, the rates were higher, but it only cost about, the median multiple was about 3.
Yeah, that's right.
In 70s and 80s.
Correct. That's exactly right.
So your ability to, you know, 10 times your household income versus 3.5 to 4 times your household income, that's the only really, I guess, era to era or different generational measure that you can show that why it's so much harder now.
So what happens next? This is the thing that gets me. There's people in the market who are saying that with the glide path to the Olympics that we're going to see prices keep on increasing. But no one's talking about the incomes increasing. So if the incomes are going to grow by, you know, maybe 2% if you're lucky, for people on working class and middle class incomes. And if house prices then end up at 15 times or even 20 times, what happens then? I mean, I just don't. One part of me does not understand how that can possibly happen, how that stretch between your incomes and the actual price can go on like that, unless you get 60-year mortgages or intergenerational debt.
Well, in infinite economic growth is obviously a topic that we're sort of getting wrapped up in here. But, yeah, I mean, prices can't outstrip wage growth forever unless you want to end up with basically a small percentage of the population being landlords and owning 30 properties.
Yes, exactly. And what happens then is the governments intervene with wealth taxes, inheritance taxes.
Make it less attractive for those investors to actually own all those properties.
And they want to redistribute the wealth. So, and that's, I think, the ultimate end game. If this keeps going without some sort of, you know, pressure valve releasing, then that's what we're looking at, particularly, dare I say, with the Labor government in Canberra. They'll look for every...
And look, we touched on this in the last podcast. You know, one thing I can say hand on heart, the price growth in these land markets is not developers making more money. Developers are still operating on the same margins, but the cost to deliver it plus the margin is going higher and higher and higher. But no one's changing their target margin for a development, but the cost base just keeps getting higher. The government red tape keeps getting more significant. The lack of planning, infrastructure, and particularly servicing makes it harder to bring the supply we need to the market. And I guess, you know, that probably leads me to my next question. I might have even answered it, but what are the biggest barriers you see or that for bringing new greenfield land supply to the market in Southeast Queensland? You know, things like planning, infrastructure, funding, and construction costs.
I don't know that the infrastructure is the challenge it used to be, right? So one of the big arguments is always from government that we don't want out-of-sequence development. In other words, we don't want to approve a large housing estate 20 kilometres away from the next growth front because we'll have to install the infrastructure, the wastewater, the potable water, the energy, all the rest of it. So we have to do this in order and sequentially emanating out from wherever the
they didn't want form the, is. They didn't want the green wedges in between. They wanted to...
Yeah. But these days, the technology is there. You can have large-scale off-grid wastewater treatment, which literally puts a very big purple pipe into the pond and the ducks and whatever can swim around, and they're quite okay with it. That's been deployed on a number of sites in Melbourne where they've just recognised that getting the full-scale wastewater out to a... development that might be out of sequence is too costly, doesn't work. So they put in large-scale off-grid systems that will work for 10 or 15 years until it reaches a certain level. Then you connect back into the grid or you get the grid out there. Energy can be produced on site these days. It's not all that efficient, but it's easier to get energy off-grid. Telecommunications, well, that's just one of Elon's satellites these days. It's better than NBN. So what sort of services mean that you can't develop some of the land that we've got in Southeast Queensland? So I don't know. I think that argument doesn't stack up like it used to. And there's now, I think, every reason to look at accelerating growth on the urban fringes where land is cheaper and where the building form is cheaper. But I would, in my view, if you do that, you've also then got to make sure that it just doesn't become a discussion only about housing. Otherwise, you set up big dormitory communities and you'll be asking them to commute long distances to access work or schools or hospitals. So you've got to start with that social infrastructure as well.
Yep.
So if you're going to have a community of several thousand houses and it's going to be on an estate well away from an existing city, then you've got to make sure that you are committed as well to providing schools and hospitals, potentially workplaces, all the rest of it. You can't just build housing.
Yeah, I mean, the poster child for that model is obviously what Springfield Land Corporation's done out at Springfield. And certainly, I guess the comment about servicing not being a valid excuse anymore, I would agree with that. But I guess it's up to the bureaucrats or those in power to approve developments using the technology you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, and they don't want to do that. So the utilities companies just think this is a horrible idea. It takes
places
away
like urban utilities and things like that, they need to get on board with that technology.
Cause they do.
Ourselves included, we could come along and say we've got this great site out of sequence, you know, using that term, but we can get it delivered using all this technology, but without someone's actual approval, it's no good to us.
Yeah.
And look, yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. You can't be large dormitory suburbs or dormitory-based suburbs. I think we also covered this in a recent previous episode, but certainly when I started in this area of business, one of the number one, you know, selling points in any housing estate you'd launch, you know, you're doing your marketing bullet points in inverted commas, and proximity to the CBD was always either item one or item two. It doesn't even register these days in your marketing material because most of the people living in those locations live, work, and socialize and do their recreation in that area.
Exactly.
Not that many commute. You know, when we're selling in places like Logan and Caboolture and places like that, none of them are commuting to the, well, no, very few of them are commuting to the CBD anymore.
That's exactly right. But, you know, isn't it ironic that you can go to the census will tell you exactly that, that maybe only 5 to 10% of the people who live in those outer communities actually commute to the inner city. Everyone else is working locally. They're tradies, they're teachers, they work in hospitals, they work in the local shops, you know, whatever. And yet we have this idea in our head that if you allow a large-scale outer suburban new community, new greenfield, all of those people out there are going to want to come in here
on a regular basis.
So we're going to have to build this massive piece of expensive infrastructure for the people who don't actually want to come in here to use, because if we build it, they'll want to use it then, and they still wouldn't. It's just that idea. The myth is so powerful.
It is a strong. I mean, it's sort of like I said. We've over time, it's exited, I guess, our marketing material. I mean, we've just relocated our office into the Brisbane CBD from the Fortitude Valley, so we're, you know, splitting hairs, but until we moved our office back into the CBD, I hadn't set foot in the CBD in close to a decade, and I live 5 kilometres away. So I don't know why anyone anywhere else would need to come in there either, unless it's some kind of special occasion. So,
well, that change, that's all changing too, because the B part of the CBD, the business part, it used to be in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, it was all finance property. It was white. It was the big eight accounting firms and law firms, and you know, every second person was a Gordon Gekko lookalike, you know, and that was the growth of the office. The growth of the office demand was very strong in that era. But since then, since about 2010, there's next to no growth. Like all the jobs, or many of the jobs, have been headquartered in Sydney. So one city captures and can service most of the country. You've got the advent of technology, and then soon there'll be AI. So that's going to make a big difference to what the typical profile of a business demanding an office in the CBD was. But in exchange, you're going to see, I think, the city centres become the amenity district, the central amenity place. So if you want to go from the 5-star hotels experience, you're going to come to the inner city. If you want to go to the new arena over there and see Taylor Swift or whatever, you know, good luck. But that's going to be in the inner city, same with the games infrastructure and all the rest of it. That's what will pull people in, but it won't be on a daily basis. And I think some of those jobs, particularly health and education, the fastest growing industries, I keep making the point, they are suburban jobs by their very nature. So you don't see people walking around in surgical gowns down Queen Street Mall, you know. So it's all changing, I guess, Andrew. That's the point.
Absolutely. No, that's sort of the angle I was going for. So it's good we're in agreement. I guess getting back to those supply challenges and, you know, we were talking about that new technology and me sort of saying, well, it's all well and good to say that's not a good excuse. But I guess that leads me to my next question is how significant is the role of state and local government and their planning approval process in limiting the speed of supply or bringing, you know, new land delivery to the market?
I feel quite sorry for local government because they are the last person in line. Now, the demand is being created by the federal government through immigration policy. No, we can't walk away from that. 500,000 people in a year is just off the charts. It wouldn't be so bad if we had the infrastructure capacity to keep up, or if we had the decision-making capacity to keep up, but we don't. So the reality is, as I said before, our responsiveness is slowed down because community have expectations and standards and, you know, all this sort of stuff. Everyone has to have their say. So the whole process of meeting supply is slowed down. Plus at the local government end, they only get 3 cents in the tax dollar. The feds get most of it. They'll pass some through to the state. And then if the council's lucky, they might get some partnerships with the state.
The local government's left holding the can, grossly under-resourced.
Yep.
For decisions made by the federal government.
Yep, basically.
And they've got developers banging down the door saying, give me what I want at a faster rate.
And with some fairness to the developers too, I've got to say, because, you know, the local government planning and regulatory systems are not exactly, they're not Formula One, are they? I mean, it can take a long time. And even then, if you get an approval these days, an approval might have 20 or 50 conditions attached to it. And each of those conditions is a compliance challenge in itself. So, we haven't made it easy on ourselves. The state government, I think, through the regional, particularly the regional planning framework and through their infrastructure strategy, have a great opportunity to match growth with infrastructure and jobs. In the last regional plan under the previous government, there was a massive mismatch between where they foresaw population growth happening and where they foresaw jobs happening. And places like City of Moreton Bay were being set up for a massive commuter fail, Ipswich too, and probably Logan, in that they wanted all the housing growth but no jobs. And they weren't matching the infrastructure to those things as well. So there's an opportunity, I think, to say across, say, South East Queensland, if you're a Noosa and you don't want growth, fair enough. But you'd also, you're not going to get buckets of money or loads of planning support. You just want to be mothballed there for 5 years or 10 years. We'll come back and talk to you later. Who in South East Queensland wants the growth? Let's go talk to those councils and make sure that within those areas, there are landowners who want to get going as well. Because there's no point, if we've got to bring this on quickly, we can't delay any further, otherwise this crisis gets worse. So you've got to be looking at not just where to put it, but who with, and the answer to the who ought to be who can move fastest. Who's got the capital, who's ready to go, who's ready for the tick, the bit of paper, let's get on with it.
Yeah, and I guess on the same topic, what extent do you think construction and civil works pricing growth is affecting feasibility of these new projects that we're trying to get off the ground?
Well, a lot, obviously. Everyone in the industry has got the same thing to say, that particularly for tier two and tier one builders, it's going to be a massive problem just because of the volume of work, and they're going to be choosy. I think if there's a market that you can work with tier three builders, and let's face, stick and brick building is a tier three market. Maybe not at scale, but it can still be done. The tier three builder market is capable of responding quicker. I would have thought. That's just my view.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you want to get something done quickly, make sure it's under five stories, and make sure it's something that can be delivered by tier three. Our tier three could probably do five and a bit more, but you know what I mean.
I guess we're working our way through the development cycle here, and we're there's a problem at acquisition, there's a problem at approval. Now we're going to approve project, but there's still impacts being felt through construction pricing and also availability or shortage of trades and materials that can then delay project delivery even for an approved and funded project. So there's things hampering supply at every step of the development cycle.
Utilities as well, as you mentioned before, Urban Utilities, Unity Water, Ergon, Energex, they're all becoming quite notorious for their lack of responsiveness.
Yes, yes. No, I can agree with that. Probably a topic for a whole entire another podcast. But I guess moving on from those challenges, focusing on Southeast Queensland market, which corridors or regions you think are seeing the strongest demand for greenfield development, and why do you think those regions are seeing that?
I think the demand goes where the supply is available at the moment, isn't it? I mean, it's a region that's trying to pack a lot more people in very quickly. So if a development front opened up and the scenic rim, for example, the demand would go there, I have no doubt. Because the corridors north and south of the city are almost exhausted. Yeah, and we're still, for some reason, hanging on to big swathes of sugarcane land just south of Brisbane. I mean, it's just idiotic almost, but how long that lasts, I don't know. So, look, if it goes west, it goes northwest, it might go southwest of CBD Brisbane. That's where it's going to happen. Lockyer, potentially out that way in around Gatton, Laidley, Grantchester.
I mean, Brisbane does have the advantage that perhaps, well, certainly Sydney doesn't have, is we're not landlocked. I mean, there's plenty of places the urban growth can spread, a little bit like Melbourne, whereas Sydney's sort of surrounded by mountains and ocean, and they've almost filled every gap.
Yeah, all we're lacking, we've actually got plenty of supply. We have a shortage of permission.
Yeah.
Right? It's as simple as that. It's almost a stroke of a pen simplicity.
Yeah.
I go, we've got a little farm south of our desert, and sometimes heading down that way, I'll take a little detour, just that sticky beak, and there's a huge amount of land down there at Verrisdale and Verrisdale South, which used to be dairy country, because you can still see the big dairy sheds.
Yeah.
It says they're grazing beef cattle now, most of it.
But we're talking hundreds and hundreds of hectares of land.
Flat usable land
with the services. So the power lines are in. And I imagine there's underground services for wastewater that could be developed, but it is prohibited basically because it's not the right colour on the map.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. It's no longer viable for dairy. Cattle don't have to be there on what I would call prime land. What else do you do with it? Well, if you've got a shortage of housing, you'd have to say, why not?
Yeah, no, it makes sense, which is probably why it's not happening. and I guess, you know, opportunities for developers, and this is an interesting one, you know, line greenfield projects with infrastructure investment, such as transport links, amenities, schools. But I guess we touched on it before. What's considered a transport link or what's important about a transport link can vary because, as we said, you know, typically the transport links was all about getting to the CBD, whereas I would argue a project in northwest of Brisbane, the only relevant transport link is how you get to the airport and how you get to the Sunshine Coast.
Yeah, maybe to Caboolture.
Yeah.
In fact, Caboolture emerges as a mini CBD in its own right.
Yeah.
There's a big hospital there, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the next big growth area for southeast Queensland, and that's certainly somewhere we're operating. We probably don't want to drag on too long. Are you seeing a shift in buyer preferences, smaller lots, master planning communities, more integrated amenities, or do you think the shift to smaller lots is purely just on a related to affordability?
It's probably related. If you have a slightly larger lot, you'd have one if you could.
Exactly.
I mean, it's as simple as that. If you could live in a detached house as opposed to an apartment, if you're going to, particularly if you're raising a family, you would if you could.
Yeah.
So the choices we're making now, or what demand is doing now, is in response to constraints on all sides. You know, it's affordability, constructability, availability of land, how the land is designated, what the council or the planning scheme tells you must do with that land, how much land you must set aside for open space, parks, all the rest of it, how wide the roads have to be. It's just, as you know, it's a massively big list, and that tends to dictate what that supply will look like. It's not so much an issue of consumer choice anymore. Partly, I think, because the preferred choice of the consumer has been demonized. You know, I've been told they're wrong.
Mm.
We can't afford, who this we is, I don't know, but we can't afford to have, you know, the Australian dream anymore of everyone in their own home. Well, we can actually. It's just you don't want to allow it. And I think that's the real shame of what we're doing around the country. Things in, say, New South Wales are particularly bad, and Victoria is particularly bad because it's very paternalistic, deterministic, father knows best sort of approach to where we're going to allow housing and what it's going to look like and why you're going to love it.
Yeah, I mean, look, for us, you know, or myself, you know, just in my own social conversations, and people know that, you know, I'm involved in development. When someone asks me about lot sizes, I'm almost embarrassed to answer how small they're getting, but it's driven by trying to create an affordable product, and the supply is so constrained, you to get the affordability back or get something that would even be considered remotely affordable, the lot size has to shrink. Whereas perhaps lot sizes could reach a more manageable level and slightly bigger if we did all the other things about increasing supply, you wouldn't have to pack them in like sardines, so to speak. So
that's exactly right.
And so I guess, you know, looking ahead, sort of not answering my own question, but leading onto it, what policy and market changes do you think would help unlock new greenfield land supply to try and meet, you know, the population growth that our South Queensland's experiencing and is going to experience for the next 10 years?
Well, I think some of the ideology that's kind of infected that the regional planning in the past has got to change. And I think under this government that is changing, as I said earlier, you've got to work with the local authorities that are genuinely open for business, not just saying that, that's because it's a platitude. But you work with the ones who are willing to work with the private sector and deliver that growth, and you work with the landowners in those local authority areas who've got the sites, who can get on with it, who've got the means to do it. So they're not just there waiting for some uplift in land value as a result of rezoning. They actually want to build and develop. So you'd be talking to those people. Changing that ideology about, you know, the demonisation, if you like, of sprawl, which is a very pejorative term. And understanding that if you want fast response to supply of an affordable nature, it's not going to be high-density apartments in the inner city. It's not going to happen. It's just the opposite effect. the actual opposite effect.
It's cost going to a fortune and take years to supply.
That's yeah. right. In fact, I think for a major apartment building, between when a developer might identify a site and run some initial schemes on it, talk to their planners, architects, take an option out on it maybe, then some pre-lodgement meeting with the council, then go away and actually firm up the plans and the designs, maybe get a preliminary construction quote, then go talk to the council about lodging the DA gets assessed, DA ultimately may get approved with a whole bunch of conditions, evaluate those conditions, tender for the building, then by the five years.
Pre-sales process.
So the pre-sale. And so it's 10 years between start and finish, 10 years. It's an extraordinary long amount of time. And then at the end of that 10 years, you've got, 250, 350 apartments, and they're all going to be at least $1.5 million.
And nearly every number that you've assessed it on when you first looked at it has experienced significant increases both in your cost base and your revenue base.
Whereas a house...
Over a 10-year period, it's going to change.
Whereas a house can be built a lot quicker. And the Greenfield estate, well, that will take a bit of time. Provided you can get the utilities companies on board, it doesn't have to take a long time. You can get in and do your civils, your streets, your other bits and pieces, and the house itself can be built in, 6 months?
Oh,
nine
well
months?
And truly. Yeah, well and truly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you can, some of them are 28 weeks. I guess we've probably gone a little bit over our normal time, but, it's pretty intriguing topic, so easy to, tick over. So I think we'll have to wrap it up there, but really appreciate you coming on, Ross. And I think, there's some really good insights there about what's going on in the market. And it's good to hear it from someone other than a developer because, often the overarching sort of narrative is just developers whinging all the time and developers are just trying to make more profit because they want to reduce lot sizes and they want to do this and do that. So actually we're just trying to run a business and meet land supply, and it's a very difficult market to do that within the conditions we're all operating in at the moment. So getting a bit of expert opinion of why that is and what's causing it and most importantly how it can be fixed is I think very interesting for our listeners to hear. So I really appreciate you coming on and giving us that insight.
Thanks, Andrew. It was good fun. Enjoyed it.